I'm shorter than you thought. Well, that's kind of hard to follow, but we'll give it a try. Okay, I'm going to start by reading a piece that I wrote in a fit of peevishness called Women's Novels. And I think I was peevish because too many people had asked me whether or not I wrote women's novels. And you may think this is a simple question, but it's not, because whoever is asking it usually has some subversive reason. Some people think that women's novels are any novels written by women, in which case, yes, I write women's novels. And some people think that women's novels are any novels with any women in them at all, which includes War and Peace, but does not include Moby Dick. And some people think that women's novels are strident feminist propaganda, and other people think that women's novels are those things that you can buy in the supermarket that have doctors and nurses on the front, or antebellum mansions with Spanish moss crinolines and parasols, or even better, castles in the background, maidens fleeing across the foreground, and in the middle distance, a gentleman in a cloak and boots. And I think that most people who ask that question really mean this last kind of novel. And so therefore, for these people, I wrote the following piece, which comes in 7 parts for diverse voices and is dedicated to my sister-in-law, who keeps asking me, how come I don't write women's novels? Because if I did, I could make $1 million. So, think of it as a kind of cantata. 1. Men's novels are about men. Women's novels are about men, too, but from a different point of view. You can have a men's novel with no women in it, except possibly the landlady or the horse. But you can't have a women's novel with no men in it. Sometimes men put women in men's novels, but they leave out some of the parts. The heads, for instance. Or the hands. Women's novels leave out parts of the men as well. Sometimes it's the stretch between the belly button and the knees. Sometimes it's the sense of humor. It's hard to have a sense of humor in a cloak. In a high wind. On a moor. Women do not usually write novels of the type favored by men, but men are known to write novels of the type favored by women. Some people find this odd. 2. I like to read novels in which the heroine has a costume rustling discreetly over her breasts, or discreet breasts rustling under her costume. In any case, there must be a costume, some breasts, some rustling, and overall discretion. Discretion over all, like a fog, a miasma through which the outlines of things appear only vaguely, a glimpse of pink through the gloom, the sound of breathing, satin slithering to the floor, revealing what? Never mind, I say. Never, never mind. 3. Men favor heroes who are tough and hard, tough with men, hard with women. Sometimes the hero goes soft on a woman, but this is always a mistake. Women do not favor heroines who are tough and hard. Instead, they have to be tough and soft. This leads to linguistic difficulties. Last time we looked, monosyllables were male, still dominant but sinking fast, wrapped in the octopoid arms of labial polysyllables, whispering to them with arachnoid grace, "Darling, darling, for." Men's novels are about how to get power, killing and so on, or winning and so on. So are women's novels, though the method is different. In men's novels, getting the woman or women goes along with getting the power. It's a perk, not a means. In women's novels, you get the power by getting the man. The man is the power. But sex won't do. He has to love you. What do you think all that kneeling's about? Down among the crinolines. On the Persian carpet. Or at least say it. When all else is lacking, verbalization can be enough. Love. There, you can stand up now. It didn't kill you. Did it? 5. I no longer want to read about anything sad, anything violent, anything disturbing, anything like that. No funerals at the end, though there can be some in the middle. If there must be deaths, let there be resurrections, or at least a heaven so we know where we are. Depression and squalor are for those under 25. They can take it. They even like it. They still have enough time left. But real life is bad for you. Hold it in your hand long enough and you'll get pimples and become feeble-minded. You'll go blind. I want happiness, guaranteed. Joy all round. Covers with nurses on them or brides. Intelligent girls, but not too intelligent. With regular teeth and pluck and both breasts the same size and no excess facial hair. Someone you can depend on to know where the bandages are and to turn the hero, that potential rake and killer, into a well-groomed country gentleman with clean fingernails and the right vocabulary. Always, he has to say, forever. I no longer want to read books that don't end with the word forever. I want to be stroked between the eyes, one way only. 6. Some people think a woman's novel is anything without politics in it. Some think it's anything about relationships. Some think it's anything with a lot of operations in it. Medical ones, I mean. Some think it's anything that doesn't give you a broad panoramic view of our exciting times. Me, well, I just want something you can leave on the coffee table and not be too worried if the kids get into it. You think that's not a real consideration? You're wrong. 7. She had the startled eyes of a wild bird. This is the kind of sentence I go mad for. I would like to be able to write such sentences without embarrassment. I would like to be able to read them without embarrassment. If I could only do these two simple things, I feel, I would be able to pass my allotted time on this earth like a pearl wrapped in velvet. She had the startled eyes of a wild bird. Ah, but which one? A screech owl, perhaps. Or a cuckoo. It does make a difference. We do not need more literalists of the imagination. They cannot read a body like a gazelle's without thinking of intestinal parasites, zoos, and smells. She had a feral gaze, like that of an untamed animal, I read. Reluctantly, I put down the book, thumb still inserted at the exciting moment. He's about to crush her in his arms, pressing his hot, devouring, hard, demanding mouth to hers. As her breasts squish out the top of her dress, but I can't concentrate. Metaphor leads me by the nose into the maze, and suddenly all Eden lies before me. Porcupines, weasels, warthogs, and skunks, their feral gazes, malicious or bland or stolid or piggy and sly. Agony to see the romantic frisson quivering just out of reach, a dark-winged butterfly stuck to an overripe peach, and not be able to swallow or wallow. Which one, I murmur to the unresponding air. Which one? I ended that with a question because I read in a piece of criticism once that women's novels end with questions. So I just want the critics to know that they do have an influence. Well, I thought that needed a companion piece, so I did it. And it's called Men at Sea. And it goes like this. You can come to the end of talking about women talking. In restaurants, cafes, kitchens, less frequently in bars or pubs, about relatives, relations, relationships, illnesses, jobs, children, men. About nuance, hunch, intimation, intuition, shadow, about themselves and each other, about what he said to her, and she said to her, and she said back, about what they feel. Something more definite, more outward then, some action to drain the inner swamp, sweep the inner fluff out from under the inner bed, harden the edges. Men at sea, for instance, not on a submarine, too claustrophobic and smelly, but something more bracing, a tang of salt, cold water, all over your calloused body, cuts and bruises, hurricanes, bravery, and above all, no women. Women are replaced by water, by wind, by the ocean, shifting and treacherous. A man has to know what to do, to navigate, to sail, to bail. So reach for the how-to book, and out here it's what he said to him, or didn't say, a narrowing of the eyes, sizing the bastard up before the pounce, the knife to the gut, and here comes a wave, hang on to the shrouds, all teeth grit, all muscles bulge together. Or sneaking along the gangway, the passageway, the right of way, the Milky Way, in the dark, your eyes shining like digital wristwatches, and the bushes, barrels, scuppers, ditches, filthy with enemies, and you on the prowl for adrenaline and loot. Corpses of your own making, deliquesce behind you, as you reach the cave, abandoned city, safe, sliding panel, hole in the ground, and rich beyond your wildest dreams. What now? Spend it on some woman in a restaurant. And there I am, back again at the eternal table, which exists so she can put her elbows on it over a glass of wine while he says. What does he say? He says the story of how he got here to her. She says, but what did you feel? And his eyes roll wildly. Quick as a wink, he tries to think of something else, a cactus, a porpoise. Never give yourself away, while the seductive waves swell the carpet beneath the feet and the wind freshens among the tablecloths. They're all around her. She can see it now, one per woman per table, men at sea. I'm going to read a mean piece with a bad word in it, unless there are any objections. The bad word is used entirely in context, so it's excusable. I don't just throw them about, but once in a while, no other word will do. This piece is called Happy Endings, and I wrote it in a fit of rage. It wasn't even just peevishness, it was more serious than that. Because too many people had asked me, why don't your books have happy endings? And I thought the endings to my books were happy enough, considering what was around. And it turned out, however, that they weren't happy enough for these people. So for these people who wanted the endings to be happier, I wrote Happy Endings. It also has a Canadian joke in it, which I think is appropriate, considering the co-sponsorship of this event. I'm reading this piece for you, you folks. Happy Endings. John and Mary meet. What happens next? If you want a happy ending, try A. A. John and Mary fall in love and get married. They both have worthwhile and remunerative jobs, which they find stimulating and challenging. They buy a charming house. Real estate values go up. Eventually, when they can afford live-in help, they have two children. To whom they are devoted. The children turn out well. John and Mary have a stimulating and challenging sex life and worthwhile friends. They go on fun vacations together. They retire. They both have hobbies which they find stimulating and challenging. Eventually they die. This is the end of the story. B. Mary falls in love with John, but John doesn't fall in love with Mary. He merely uses her body for selfish pleasure and ego gratification of a tepid kind. He comes to her apartment twice a week, and she cooks him dinner. You'll notice that he doesn't even consider her worth the price of a dinner out. And after he's eaten the dinner, he fucks her, and after that he falls asleep while she does the dishes, so he won't think she's untidy, having all those dirty dishes lying around, and puts on fresh lipstick so she'll look good when he wakes up. But when he wakes up, he doesn't even notice. He puts on his socks and his shorts and his pants and his shirt and his tie and his shoes. The reverse order from the one in which he took them off. He doesn't take off Mary's clothes. She takes them off herself. She acts as if she's dying for it every time, not because she likes sex exactly. She doesn't, but she wants John to think she does, because if they do it often enough, surely he'll get used to her. He'll come to depend on her, and they will get married. But John goes out the door with hardly so much as a good night, and 3 days later he turns up at 6 o'clock, and they do the whole thing over again. Mary gets run down. Crying is bad for your face. Everyone knows that, and so does Mary, but she can't stop. People at work notice. Her friends tell her John is a rat, a pig, a dog. He isn't good enough for her, but she can't believe it. Inside John, she thinks, is another John who is much nicer. This other John will emerge like a butterfly from a cocoon, a jack from a box, a pit from a prune. If the first John is only squeezed enough. One evening, John complains about the food. He has never complained about the food before. Mary is hurt. Her friends tell her they've seen him in a restaurant with another woman whose name is Madge. It's not even Madge that finally gets to Mary, it's the restaurant. John has never taken Mary to a restaurant. Mary collects all the sleeping pills and aspirin she can find and takes them and half a bottle of sherry. You can see what kind of a woman she is by the fact that it's not even whiskey. She leaves a note for John. She hopes he'll discover her and get her to the hospital in time and repent, and then they can get married, but this fails to happen and she dies. John marries Madge, and everything continues as in A. Wait. The other way round. John, who is an older man, falls in love with Mary, and Mary, who is only 22, feels sorry for him because he's worried about his hair falling out. She sleeps with him even though she's not in love with him. She met him at work. She's in love with someone called James, who is 22 also and not yet ready to settle down. John, on the contrary, settled down long ago. This is what is bothering him. John has a steady, respectable job and is getting ahead in his field, but Mary isn't impressed by him. She's impressed by James, who has a motorcycle and a fabulous record collection. But James is often away on his motorcycle, being free. Freedom isn't the same for girls, so in the meantime, Mary spends Thursday evenings with John. Thursdays are the only days John can get away. John is married to a woman called Madge, and they have two children, a charming house which they bought just before the real estate values went up, and hobbies which they find stimulating and challenging when they have the time. John tells Mary how important she is to him, but of course he can't leave his wife because a commitment is a commitment. He goes on about this more than is necessary, and Mary finds it boring, but older men can keep it up longer, so on the whole, she has a fairly good time. James breezes in on his motorcycle with some top-grade California hybrid, and James and Mary get higher than you'd believe possible, and they climb into bed. Everything becomes very underwater, but along comes John, who has a key to Mary's apartment. He finds them stoned and entwined. He's hardly in any position to be jealous, considering Madge, but nevertheless he's overcome with despair. Finally, he's middle-aged. In 2 years, he'll be bald as an egg, and he can't stand it. He purchases a handgun, saying he needs it for target practice. This is the thin part of the plot. But it can be dealt with later, and shoots the two of them and himself. Madge, after a suitable period of mourning, marries an understanding man called Fred, and everything continues as in A, but under different names. D. Fred and Madge have no problems. They get along exceptionally well and are good at working out any little difficulties that may arise. But their charming house is by the seashore, and one day a giant tidal wave approaches. Real estate values go down. The rest of the story is about what caused the tidal wave and how they escape from it. They do, though thousands drown. Some of the story is about how the thousands drown. But Fred and Madge are virtuous and lucky. Finally, on high ground, they clasp each other, wet and dripping and grateful, and continue as in A. E. Yes, but Fred has a bad heart. The rest of the story is about how kind and understanding they both are until Fred dies. Then Madge devotes herself to charity work until the end of A. If you like, it can be Madge, cancer, guilty and confused, and bird watching. F. If you think this is all too bourgeois, make John a revolutionary and Mary a counter-espionage agent, and see how far that gets you. Remember, this is Canada. You'll still end up with A. Though in between, you may get a lustful, brawling saga of passionate involvement, a chronicle of our times, sort of. You'll have to face it. The endings are the same, however you slice it. Don't be deluded by any other endings. They're all fake, either deliberately fake, with malicious intent to deceive, or just motivated by excessive optimism, if not by downright sentimentality. The only authentic ending is the one provided here. John and Mary die. John and Mary die. John and Mary die. So much for endings. Beginnings are always more fun. True connoisseurs, however, are known to favor the stretch in between, since it's the hardest to do anything with. That's about all that can be said for plots, which anyway are just one thing after another. A what and a what and a what. Now try how and why. Because I know you have lots of writers here and lots of writers in the audience, I'm going to read a piece called The Page, which is in 5 tiny parts. 1. The page waits, pretending to be blank. Is that its appeal, its blankness? What else is this smooth and white, this terrifyingly innocent? A snowfall, a glacier? It's a desert, totally arid, without life. But people venture into such places. Why? To see how much they can endure, how much dry light. 2. I've said the page is white, and it is. White as wedding dresses, rare whales, seagulls, angels, ice, and death. Some say that like sunlight, it contains all colors. Others that it's white because it's hot, it will burn out your optic nerves, that those who stare at the page too long go blind. 3. The page itself has no dimensions and no directions. There's no up or down except what you yourself mark. There's no thickness and weight but those you put there. North and south do not exist unless you are certain of them. The page is without vistas and without sounds, without centers or edges. Because of this, you can become lost in it forever. Have you never seen the look of gratitude, the look of joy, on the faces of those who have managed to return from the page? Despite their faintness, their loss of blood, they fall on their knees, they push their hands into the earth, they clasp the bodies of those they love, or in a pinch, any bodies they can get, with an urgency unknown to those who have never experienced the full horror of a journey into the page. 4. If you decide to enter the page, take a knife and some matches and something that will float. Take something you can hold on to and a prism to split the light and a talisman that works, which should be hung on a chain around your neck. That's for getting back. It doesn't matter what kind of shoes, but your hands should be bare. You should never go into the page with gloves on. Such decisions, needless to say, should not be made lightly. There are those, of course, who enter the page without deciding, without meaning to. Some of these have charmed lives and no difficulty, but most never make it out at all. For them, the page appears as a well, a lovely pool in which they catch sight of a face, their own but better. These unfortunates do not jump. Rather, they fall, and the page closes over their heads without a sound, without a seam, and is immediately as whole and empty, as glassy, as enticing as before. 5. The question about the page is, what is beneath it? It seems to have only 2 dimensions. You can pick it up and turn it over, and the back is the same as the front. Nothing, you say, disappointed. But you were looking in the wrong place. You were looking on the back instead of beneath. Beneath the page is another story. Beneath the page is a story. Beneath the page is everything that has ever happened, most of which you would rather not hear about. The page is not a pool, but a skin. A skin is there to hold in, and it can feel you touching it. Did you really think it would just lie there and do nothing? Touch the page at your peril. It is you who are blank and innocent, not the page. Nevertheless, you want to know. Nothing will stop you. You touch the page. It's as if you've drawn a knife across it. The page has been hurt now. A sinuous wound opens, a thin incision. Darkness wells through. I'm going to switch to poetry now, and I'm going to read a couple of poems that were originally published in your very own magazine, The River Styx, and they're from a series called Snake Poems. I feel that if you're going to write nature poems in the 20th century, you have to get serious about it. Just daffodils won't do. All the way, I say. One of my next sequences will undoubtedly be on hookworms. So, first one is autobiographical. I taught nature at a summer camp populated almost entirely by people from cities, and they were all very frightened of snakes, except me. There are no poisonous snakes in that part of the country, so their fear was unwarranted. But you can see that the fact that they were frightened of them and I was not gave me tremendous power. So the snake in question is the harmless garter snake, and the poem is called Snake Woman. I was once the snake woman, the only person, it seems, in the whole place who wasn't terrified of them. I used to hunt with two sticks among milkweed and under porches and logs for this vein of cool green metal which would run through my fingers like mercury or turn to a raw bracelet gripping my wrist. I could follow them by their odor, a sick smell, acid and glandular, part skunk, part inside of a torn stomach, the smell of their fear. Once caught, I'd carry them, limp and terrorized, into the dining room, something even men were afraid of. What fun I had. Put that thing in my bed and I'll kill you. Now I don't know. Now I'd consider the snake. On the other hand, with snakes, two points of view are always possible. So in this poem, I put everything bad that can possibly be said about snakes. And it's called Bad Mouth. And it's meticulously researched. There are no leaf-eating snakes. All happens to be true. There are no leaf-eating snakes. All are fanged and gorge on blood. Each one is a hunter's hunter, nothing more than an endless gullet pulling itself on over the still alive prey, like a sock gone ravenous, like an evil glove, like sheer greed, lithe and devious. Puff adder buried in hot sand, or poisoning the toes of boots, for whom killing is easy and careless as war, as digestion. Why should you be spared? And you, constrictor, constrictor, sinuous ribbon of true darkness, one long muscle with eyes and an anus, looping like thick tar out of the trees to squeeze the voice from anything edible, reducing it to scales and a belly. And you, pit viper, with your venomous pallid throat and teeth like syringes, and your nasty radar homing in on the deep red shadow nothing else knows it casts. Shall I concede these deaths? Between us there is no fellow feeling. As witness, a snake cannot scream. Observe the alien chainmail skin, straight out of science fiction, pure shiver, pure Saturn. Those who can explain them can explain anything. Some say they're a snarled puzzle only gasoline and a match can untangle. Even their mating is barely sexual, a romance between two lengths of cyanide-colored string. Despite their live births and squirming nests, it's hard to believe in snakes loving. Alone among the animals, the snake does not sing. The reason for them is the same as the reason for stars, and not human. On the other hand, one occasionally indulges in metaphysics, which goes like this. This is a poem called Eating Snake, which in fact I have done, and it's true that snake does taste like chicken. However, eating is always filled with significance in religions. Eating snake. I too have taken the god into my mouth, chewed it up and tried not to choke on the bones. Rattlesnake it was, pan-fried, and good too, though a little oily. Forget the phallic symbolism. Two differences. Snake tastes like chicken. And whoever credited the prick with wisdom? All peoples are driven to the point of eating their gods after a time. It's the old greed for a plateful of outer space, that craving for darkness, the lust to feel what it does to you when your teeth meet in divinity, in the flesh, when you swallow it down and you can see with its own cold eyes, look out through murder. This is a lot of fuss to make about mere lunch. Metaphysics with onions. The snake was not served with its tail in its mouth, as would have been appropriate. Instead, the cook nailed the skin to the wall, complete with rattles, and the head was mounted. It was only a snake, after all. Nevertheless, the authorities are agreed. God is round. Now we go to India for a poem called Metempsychosis, that being the doctrine that when you die, your soul migrates into another form of life. If you have been good, you get to be a spaniel, and if you have been bad, you get to be a politician. Anyway, metempsychosis. Somebody's grandmother glides through the bracken in widow's black and graceful and sharp as ever. See how her eyes glitter. Who were you when you were a snake? This one was a dancer who is now a green streamer waved by its own breeze. And here is your blunt-striped uncle come back to bask under the wicker chairs on the porch and watch over you. Unfurling itself from its cast skin, the snake proclaims resurrection to all believers. Though some tire soon of being born over and over, for them there's the breath that shivers in the yellow grass, a papery finger, half of a noose, a summons to the dead river. Who's that in the cold cellar with the apples and the rats? Whose is that voice of a husk rasping in the wind? Your lost child whispering mother, the one more child you never had, your child who wants back in. And the last snake poem I'll read is called After Heraclitus. Heraclitus having been the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher who said, all nature is a fire, and was probably righter than Plato. After Heraclitus, the snake is one name of God, my teacher said. All nature is a fire we burn in and are renewed, one skin shed and then another. To talk with the body is what the snake does, letter after letter formed on the grass, itself a tongue looping its earthy hieroglyphs, the sunlight praising it as it shines there on the doorstep, a green light blessing your house. This is the voice you could pray to for the answers to your sickness. Leave it a bowl of milk, watch it drink. You do not pray, but go for the shovel, old blood on the blade. But pick it up, and you would hold the darkness that you fear, turned flesh and embers, cool power coiling into your wrists, and it would be in your hands, where it always has been. This is the nameless one, giving itself a name, one among many, and your own name as well. You know this, and still kill it. I'll read one more poem, which is called Interlunar. The interlunar is the space between the end of the old moon and the beginning of the new moon, and the landscape is northern Canada, in what we call the glacial scrape area, where the soil covering is thin and the lakes are deep, and there are many of them, and there are no poisonous snakes, so in fact you can walk around without your shoes on at night with no flashlight. Think of that. Interlunar. Darkness waits apart from any occasion for it. Like sorrow, it is always available. This is only one kind, the kind in which there are stars above the leaves, brilliant as steel nails, and countless and without regard. We are walking together on dead wet leaves in the intermoon, among the looming nocturnal rocks, which would be pinkish gray in daylight, gnawed and softened by moss and ferns, which would be green, in the musty fresh yeast smell of trees rotting, earth returning itself to itself. And I take your hand, which is the shape a hand would be if you existed truly. I wish to show you the darkness you are so afraid of. Trust me, this darkness is a place you can enter and be as safe in as you are anywhere. You can put one foot in front of the other and believe the sides of your eyes. Memorize it. You will know it again in your own time. When the appearances of things have left you, you will still have this darkness, something of your own you can carry with you. We have come to the edge. The lake gives off its hush. In the outer night, there is a barred owl calling like a moth against the ear from the far shore, which is invisible. The lake vast and dimensionless, doubles everything, the stars, the boulders, itself, even the darkness that you can walk so long in, it becomes light.